Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to today's luncheon talk. I'm Enid Cho, co-convener of the Professional Committee. First, may I remind everyone to switch off their mobile devices. And also, please do visit the FCC website for a list of upcoming events. The next lunch is Wednesday, March 20th, when Jian Haishan of the China Executive Leadership Academy will speak on China's new policies after the National People's Congress. Without further ado, let me introduce today's speaker. Alan Chiang was appointed Privacy Commissioner for Personal Data in 2010. Since then, he has played a major role in overhauling the data protection legislation, which culminated in the enactment of the Personal Data Privacy Amendment Ordinance last year, as well as tackling a number of very high-profile cases such as the Octopus card scandal. Previously, Mr. Chiang was a career civil servant for over three decades, retiring as Postmaster General in 2006. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Chiang to the club today.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and many thanks for inviting me to this lunch, and more importantly, to deliver a speech in my subject, the right to privacy. Topic of today, of course, as you can read from the slide here, is balance between privacy rights and public interest. Now, since the establishment of the HKSAR, the constitutional protection of human rights, including the right to privacy, are enshrined in the basic law, specifically Articles 28, 29, and 30 of the basic law provide constitutional protection to personal privacy, territorial privacy, and communications privacy, respectively. Now, in addition, Article 17 of the International Covenants of Civil and Political Rights, ICCPR in short, incorporated in Article 14 of the Hong Kong Bill of Rights Ordinance provides for guarantee against arbitrary or unlawful interference with privacy. Now, further, the ICCPR requires the government to have legislations or other measures to give effect to prohibition against interference with the right to privacy. So as a result, we have this Personal Data Privacy Ordinance enacted in December 1996 to provide privacy of individuals in relation to personal data. Now, the right to privacy is not absolute. That's why we talk about the balance. Balance between this right against other rights and public interests. What are other rights? Well, we have, of course, rights talked about in the ICCPR, as well as the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. What is public interest then? Now, there is no legal definition in our ordinance or in any legislation in Hong Kong, but we can ascertain what roughly public interest is from this decision in a New Zealand court case. We're talking about criminal matters, issues of public health and safety, etc. So I'm going to go through these issues by giving examples of exemptions in the Personal Data Privacy Ordinance to illustrate how this sort of what we call public interest are actually statutorily provided in our ordinance. Now, exemptions. We're talking about basically exemptions from two principles which are protected under our ordinance. The first principle is the use limitation principle. When we collect data, we normally do it for a lawful and legitimate reason and purpose. So there's a purpose for our collection of data. But then subsequently, data are being used. And this use limitation principle requires that data are used only for purposes consistent with the original purpose of collection or a directly related purpose. So that is a very basic protection principle applied in Hong Kong and incorporated in our ordinance, and also apply, I would say, universally in other jurisdictions where data protection is being practiced. Now, the second exemption we're talking about is the right of access for individuals to gain to their own data by making the request to the corporate data users. You know, what are the personal data being held by you? Please let me have a copy. And we require the individuals have the right to make corrections. Now, exemptions, examples, criminal matters. Now, this is one public interest that has been sort of determined in our ordinance. And for obvious reasons, right? You are a criminal, you will not be able to exercise your right of access and ask the police to release your file, which contains a lot of intelligence about you for the purpose of detecting a crime. You know, of course, this cannot be exercised, right? The other thing is third parties may report information to the police or other law enforcement bodies for the purpose of detection of crime. Again, this third party would not need the prescribed consent of the individuals or the criminals involved. Again, that should be pretty obvious. So this is where public interest is being taken into account in the enforcement of the ordinance. Second example is normal government or public administration matters. One example would be the collection of tax or duty. Another example is the transfer of records, government records I'm talking about, which may contain a lot of personal data, to the government record office for archive purposes. And because we're talking about massive volumes of records, and it would be impossible for all the individuals concerned to be consulted and gave their consent before this can be done. Again, for obvious reasons, these are the exemptions. Another example, financial regulators and banks, they keep blacklists of known fraudsters and those who have a history of failed business ventures. Again, exempted. Another example, antisocial or harmful conduct. We are here not talking about civil wrong or criminal wrongs. We are talking about professional bodies like legal practitioners or accountants where serious misconduct could also have an impact on the community at large. So this again is recognized as affecting public interest. So for the purpose of preventing this sort of improper conduct from these professionals, again, exemption applies. Another example, public safety. So when it comes to problems of public security, defense, or international relations, exemption apply. And in this particular case, there is a procedure prescribed in the ordinance. The chief executive has to sign a certificate saying that the issue at hand belongs to this public safety domain, hence exempted from the two principles that I just mentioned. And where a complaint is made, lodged in my office, the chief executive has to assign a certificate and direct me not to investigate. And according to the ordinance, applying this exemption, I cannot proceed to investigate despite the complaint lodged. Another example, public health. There are cases where personal data relating to the physical or mental health of the subject, that's one personal data. Also personal data relating to the identity or location of the individuals concerned. Again, these could be exempted if the principles are to be applied strictly, this would harm the individuals concerned. No, if you don't know where he is, you don't know where the name of that individual is concerned, if you do not disclose his mental or physical health conditions, that would actually harm the individual concerned. And so in those circumstances, exemption apply. And where the harm is also may also be caused to other third parties, not to that individual, again, the same exemption applies. Now, what I've been talking about are exemptions that has been duly incorporated as provisions in the ordinance. They are statutory. There are also circumstances where circumstances have not been prescribed, and they arise from time to time. And in those circumstances, I will need to make a proper interest determination myself based on the same data principles and based what I conceive in the circumstances as what constitutes proper interest. That is a very difficult decision, I can assure you. So I will give you some examples of what I've done in the past 2 years. First example, again, a major issue, perhaps a little bit of background as to what I'm talking about. I'm talking about sharing of consumer credit data. So when you go to the banks to borrow money, you have to, of course, in your application and the subsequent transaction, disclose your data, data concerning how much money you borrow and how you are going to repay it or whatnot. And so credit provider is the bank, you know. Subsequently, the bank refuses or accepts your applications and loan money to you. So that's transactions done on a day-to-day basis. In the process, data are collected. And you, as a borrower, provides the data. That data is, according to the Hong Kong system, provided to a third party, the credit reference agency. In Hong Kong, there's only one consumer credit reference agency, and that is TransUnion, the major shareholder of which are the banks themselves. So this credit reference agency maintains a database of all these consumer credit data. And these data stored and managed by TransUnion are shared among all banks in Hong Kong. So when you go to another bank to borrow money, that bank, credit provider B, will be able to gain access to your credit history according to the data being stored and managed in that TransUnion operations. So that appropriate evaluation of your credit worthiness can be made, and lending decisions can be made also on a prudent basis. That's how it works. And the decision I make relates to a proposal from the financial services industry asking for sharing of more data, more consumer credit data. I've listed here on this slide on the situation before 1st of April 2011. I'm talking about those white boxes rather than the green boxes. So before that date, the data being held and shared by that credit reference agency with the box labeled yes, as indicated here. The request to expand the sharing of more data refers to the sharing of mortgage data. Now, mortgage data is, I think, very private compared to data relating to spending on credit cards or high purchase leasing, because it talks about how much, normally it talks about large amounts of money, how much flats you own, and how have you been paying this, and so it is very sensitive and very private, and we think that needs to be very seriously protected. So before that date, only the negative mortgage data were being shared. That's why we got the yes on the second last row there. Yes means sharing, yes. negative data. Negative data means data referring to your default position. If you default in repayment of your loan, then you have data. You have negative data. How much you still, for example, how much months your loan is overdue, you know, negative data. But when it comes to positive data, it means that even if you do not default, you still have some data held by the credit reference agency. Your repay pattern, for example, how much money you need to pay back on a monthly basis. You know, how much you still own the banks, how much mortgages you possesses in terms of payment you need to make in future. This is positive. You know, you don't default. You have positive data. So normally we think, you know, negative data for credit worthiness evaluation is fine, but when it comes to positive data, we should be more prudent. That's why before 1st of April 2011, we do not allow sharing of positive mortgage data, and the banks ask for more sharing of positive data because they think at that time, at least, you know, the problem continues, there is a fear that the property market is about to collapse for reasons. Various reasons, you know, low interest rate, you know, interest may increase again. You know, the lenders may, if they are not being prudent, they might have overborrowed, and so they might suffer. They might not be able to repay the loan, and there could be a domino effect. So the property market could be adversely affected, and that would affect the banking sector's stability and all that. So that's the basis of the request from the financial services industry to share more data. So again, I have the duty to balance between privacy right, sharing of more positive data, against other interests, you know, banking sector, stability, and all that. At the end of the day, my determination was, you know, I mean, indeed, public interest was involved. We are talking about the banking industry's stability, the financial health of Hong Kong. Although I admit that there are many factors that could affect the stability of the property market. You know, the land policy of the government, the fiscal policy of the government, the global economic development, the lending policy of the banks could also affect the stability of the property market. So whether or not sharing of more data is critical is subject to everyone's interpretation, I would say. But definitely, my conclusion is there is responsible borrowing and lending definitely should be conducive to stabilizing property market and banking sector. And because this is so important, we need to give more weight to these property interests. So I've decided that more sharing is or was acceptable, but only to a limited extent. You know, I only allow at that time sharing of the figure of number of mortgages, no more. No. So if the banks are vetting an application from the borrower, he will be able to gain access from the TransUnion's records as regards how many mortgages the borrower is having. If the banks want to find out more details, he still needs to have the specific consent of the borrower. So that was the arrangement made in those days. Now, another example, concerning about credit data. And this time, my answer was no, right? So I give you two examples. The first example, my answer was yes. This example, again, is a request from the government about sharing of students' credit data arising from the student university or post-secondary, tertiary institutions, government loan to students to help them go through the education finance. Now, the proposal was that if a student defaults, then the negative data should also go to TransUnion. So that, according to them, would deter people from not repayment, even in the circumstances when they can actually repay the amount. And the argument was public money was involved, so that means public interest. But we have to look into more deeply the issues involved, and I find, and the implications to privacy, I found, were very serious. First of all, TransUnion's operations is a very closed system. It's a sharing of consumer credit data among banks only. Banks only. Actually, banks are the majority shareholder of that company. So it's a pretty limited closed system. If we are going to say yes to the government to share the students' default data, this would open up a floodgate, I would say, to similar requests. What about the Inland Revenue Department asking for the same arrangements to release data when the taxpayer doesn't pay promptly or default or whatnot? Or when supermarkets or when telecommunication services company, when they have default problems, also make the same arrangement and disclose more and more and more of the consumer credit data to this TransUnion, which they have no control, by the way. The operations of TransUnions are, I would say, a black box operation, right? Because they're proprietary, you know, talking about keeping things confidential. We have done a test, you know, by the way, and by and large, they're okay, you know, they're pretty robust in data protection. But still, it's a black box operation. That consumers won't know what's happened inside the operation. So it is pretty, I would say, does it worth it, you know, basically. And at the end of the day, you know, we are talking about only 600 default cases. Yeah. So opening a floodgate just to cater for the interests of having a deterrent effect on 600 default cases is not good enough. So I've decided against not to accede to the request in the circumstances. Wrap up? Okay, right. Wrap up. Perhaps this interests you. We have an exemption also in our ordinance talking about disclosure to news organizations in the public interest. It's what I would say a whistleblower provision. And in the case of Fire Services Department, for example, they can apply this exemption to disclose, without the consent of the individuals, data of an accident or incident. People call up 999, and so they have got personal data involved, the address of that caller, maybe, who got into trouble. Whether or not Fire Services Department would like to disclose data to the press is up to the Fire Services to determine whether it will be in the public interest to do so. That's the application of this particular section. And in another case, which I will take one more minute to explain, because that has been widely reported in the media, so I don't need to explain the law. We're talking about disclosure. We're talking about a disclosure of some TV artist photos in a gossip magazine, two gossip magazines basically. And again, these gossip magazines say, you know, it's in the public interest to publish these photos, nude photos of a male TV artist and photos indicating intimate acts of a couple, right? So they say this is in the public interest, arguing that because these couples have been denying that they have been cohabitating, right? So in order to prove they are wrong, they need to show these photos so as to demonstrate to the public that they have been lying, that therefore they do not deserve to be the role models of the youth and all that. But the point is, do you really need these sensational and lurid photos to demonstrate this point? Are we really talking about public interest? Are we talking about interest the readers? Yes, definitely. But this is definitely not probably interest, and I have decided that in the circumstances, the collection and publication of these photos are unfair. Then, therefore, contravening the data protection principle under the ordinance. And again, you know, this is something that I've done to illustrate you the example that in every case we need to look into the specific factors involved and make a determination after taking into account all facts and circumstances. So I guess this is what I can cover in the space available to me. Now, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chang, for a comprehensive explanation of what of his office's many duties. I'm going to take this opportunity to maybe turn our attention to a topic which I think a lot of you are interested in. In May, LegCo will vote on amendments to the company's ordinance, which includes a change which will restrict public access to companies' directors' residential addresses and ID card numbers. The government, namely the Financial Services and Treasury Bureau, is neutral on this matter, and they put a lot of weight on Mr. Chiang's office's view on this when they submitted this to LegCo in May. So, Mr. Chen, do you mind just laying out your office's view on the matter, and you know why you think it's so important to change how the public are accessing companies' records at the moment?
Right. The starting point is. I'm the previous commissioner for protection of personal data in Hong Kong. And this right to privacy in relation to personal data is protected under the basic law I just explained. It has been translated into a piece of legislation, actually, the Personal Data Privacy Ordinance, which laid down clearly all the principles that should be applied in the protection of personal data. We can say that protection of personal data is a recent development because our law was enacted in year 1996. When we talk about disclosure of company directors' personal information, we're talking about something we have been doing for decades, I would say. So I would suggest, you know, when the time when the decision was made as regards how and how much to disclose in regard to personal information, due consideration could not have been taken into account as regards the recent data protection principles we are talking about, something which has been safeguarded under the basic law, something which has been laid down clearly in the Personal Data Privacy Ordinance, something we have been administrating in terms of entertaining inquiries, investigation in response to complaints and all that. So it's opportune time for the government to take into account of this data protection requirement. And they have done that, you know, because as I read from their report, they've done a proper consultation and they've gathered the views of stakeholders concerned and they have arrived at this new provisions of the company's ordinance, and we're talking about, you know, no more complete disclosure of the full identity card numbers, only partial disclosure. We are talking about, you know, there is no proper inspection of the full residential address of the company directors, only specified persons, including, for example, law enforcement authorities, will be able to gain access to this data. So this is, I would say, a very healthy development. But by the way, you know, as I mentioned in it, other jurisdictions are also doing similar things. Singapore, for example, they have just done a review and they are having also suitable amendments to the ordinance in favor of more personal data protection.
Let me open the floor to questions. Tom, you were the first to raise your hand. Go ahead.
I can't believe you just cited Singapore as an example to follow on the public
interest. Just one example among many.
But specifically, I really would like you to explain this because, of course, an ID card number is not personal data. It is government data. And how you cannot cite a public interest in disclosing identity card numbers of company directors who are entitled to public protection in the form of limited liability, there is a clear issue of public interest there. I mean, you know, I do not understand these logical contortions. Kindly explain them.
Now, first of all, the use of Hong Kong ID card numbers is a pretty unique Hong Kong problem. I mean, not Hong Kong arrangement, I put it this way, I must correct myself. Hong Kong, because not many jurisdictions have unique national or regional identification numbers. Singapore, I quote Singapore because Singapore I'll cover more than what you asked, right? You know, so that other people can share more information from my office. And Singapore, and because I need to answer that question, because Singapore prided itself. I will come to your question.
Tom, can you please let Commissioner
I will come
Chang.
To your question. If I miss your question, please come back to me. So first of all, Singapore, because you raised it and I raised it, it's because Singapore prided itself of economic efficiency, right? Commercial competitiveness and all that. So they're talking about the need also to have good due diligence. And a lot of people say due diligence require identification numbers, require residential addresses and all that, right? Okay, going back to your point about, you said, you know, ID cards is a government property, you know, something like this, right? But it's something that we use every day. Personal data, do you think ID card numbers belong to you or belong to government? It is, no, this is a very theoretical argument. But the important thing is ID cards are being used on a day-to-day basis for various reasons, including identification, including authentication. Like it or not, you know, we can have many theoretical arguments, but it's something being used by businesses and organizations for both identification and authentication, either singly or in combination with other identification data or other pre-assigned data. This is a fact. And we should assume, because the liability when it comes to troubles goes back to those businesses and organizations who make these arrangements for authentication or identification purposes. The risk is something they must have assessed appropriately, and if they are prepared to accept the risk, then there must be some value in the use of Hong Kong identity card numbers of authentication. Quoting my own experience, I've just renewed 2 credit cards and I did it through the phone. And they asked me a number of data, including my ID card numbers. Date of birth, I remember, I thought, you know, but one data they require is my Hong Kong ID card number. And I quoted that and I succeeded in the renewal of my 2 credit card numbers. Another incident I can quote, again, a recent incident, to upgrade the security device for use of internet banking services in Hong Kong by a bank, I switched to a safer security device, and they just mailed it to me by ordinary post. But I have to confirm that I received it so that I can activate this new upgraded security device. Again, I do it online. I did it online. They asked for a number of data, one of which, again, is Hong Kong ID card number. So this is a fact. ID card numbers are being used by people, which we should not assume are stupid people, for the purposes of authentication. These people are the people who bear the risks of a failure of authentication. We should assume that they have their own logic. They're prepared to accept the risk of making use of this device for authentication purposes. So okay. We should treasure the continued use of this device. Otherwise, what would be the consequence? Come on. It would be more and more face-to-face authentication. We should not be withdrawing from the use of a very useful tool and go back to the stone age
of
face-to-face
question.
Authentication.
Can Steve have the mic, please?
Mr. Chang, I have to admit, I didn't understand the answer to your last point, but let me try you on another subject. One of the worst kept secrets in Hong Kong is there's extensive personal data gathering by mainland bodies here. And I want to know what is the attitude of your organization to citizens obtaining some of that information that is collected. What is your attitude towards the collection of data on Hong Kong residents by mainland bodies? And what is your attitude towards the cooperation between the Hong Kong SAR government and mainland bodies operating in Hong Kong on data collection on individuals and organizations here?
Now, I'm administrator of the Personal Data Privacy Ordinance. It is very clear in the ordinance, collection of personal data has to be done with respect to a lawful purpose. And complaints are received on a day-to-day basis. If there is unlawful collection, that's one criteria. It has to be lawful. It has to be fair. You know, the artist's case, you know, I think the collection of the photos from artists are not fair. You know, so it has to be lawful. It has to be fair. It has to be necessary. And it has to be not excessive. So these are the words used in the ordinance. It's not my words, it's something in the legislature. And as a minister of the ordinance, I will, if a complaint is lodged, you know, try to find out whether the collection is proper or legal according to these criteria.
The gentleman over there?
Yeah. Yes. In your answer, you seem to cite the reason for to avoid identity theft. In your answer, you seem to refer to that issue. Mm-hmm. And last year, if you go to the Hong Kong police, how many reported cases were there of identity theft? I come from a country where all this information has been put in the public domain for many, many years, and this has not been any issue at all.
But first of all, I do not work in the police, so I do not have what the police can provide. But I have tried to obtain figures from them, and they're talking about figures in the past years. They're talking about slightly over 100 report cases of criminal offenses affecting concerning people's identity. But details of these, because since I'm not in the police, I do not know, right? These are published figures, I guess. But I can only talk about my experience, because we also received complaints about identity thefts, right? In the past 5 years, I have a figure here. I need to make sure I get the figure correct. In the last 5 years, we have handled 79 cases of identity thefts. We're not talking about criminal offenses. Criminal offenses, we need to refer to the police, right? But having quoted this figure of 79, I must say, not everyone aggrieved will come to this office and lodge a complaint. So I do not have a figure to ascertain the extent of the actual problem. Quoting the case of Octopus, for example, is something that we took the initiative ourselves to investigate into a problem without a complaint. But after the investigation, we find out this is something which affected 3 million people. 3 million people in possession of Autobot cards, and they're affected by serious intrusion of privacy. So,
gentleman over there has a question.
Yeah, I just I think the pitch is wrong to the audience, because the majority of people who've come here today are motivated primarily by the recent interest in the decision to limit the ability to conduct proper investigative journalism on company directors in Hong Kong. The rest of the stuff is nice to know. We're interested in it. But I think the most important thing is to, for us to properly understand the philosophy that led to this. I mean, I can understand why, for example, tax returns of people that are required to lodge aren't made publicly available to the world at large. But to me, there's a difference between that situation where you're compelled to provide that information to the state, not a private company, to the state, and a situation where you're voluntarily, you don't have to be a director, you voluntarily agree to a director, and there's an interest, a major interest in having in both shareholders and the public at large being able to properly scrutinise who owns those things, particularly, I mean, you must be aware of it, but you haven't mentioned it, the recent press scrutiny of PRC government officials and their interests that have been exposed in Hong Kong. Privacy is used to, in my opinion, shut down, you know, proper scrutiny of celebrities, public officials, people with, you know, vested economic interests and stuff. And it just you seem to be simply making these subjective judgments without proper explanation of the philosophy which give rise to those decisions.
No, I think I've explained clearly in my the presentation that privacy right is not absolute. That's why it has to be balanced against other civil and political and socio-economic rights as well as public interest, right? And I have quoted examples in my presentation that are actual examples of where there are statutory determinations as regards to the circumstances where exemptions should apply. And I quoted one example, Section 61, which I don't have time to go through in detail. But this is something I always talk about. I respect freedom of press, freedom of speech and all that. And actually, in our ordinance, there is an exception which accommodates this exemption. So I respect investigative journalism. This is something we have to take into account. And there are benchmarks. There are already real examples in our ordinance where this has been accommodated. I'm not saying, I never said, no. Privacy is absolute, privacy is everything. Irrespective of other rights, and therefore we should forget about investigative journalism, we should forget about freedom of expression, freedom of press. No, I didn't say that. I would say a balance is needed. And it, at the end of the day, it will be incumbent upon the government to assess the various interests and come to a community census. From my perspective, I'm talking about dealing with complaints and inquiries every day about privacy intrusions. I have that experience. So I should speak from that standpoint. But there are other interests we should take into account, which I duly respect. That is very true, very fair. And a lot of people have raised their voices. At the end of the day, you know, it's the government who will need to come up with sort of, after taking into account of the voices and wills of the stakeholders, come up with a sort of middle of the road, compromise, balancing a solution, and let the legislature endorse or approve whatever they come up with. So I'm not determining anything on behalf of the community or on behalf of the government. I duly respect there is a need to balance against other economic interests. But at the end of the day, everything has to be balanced, right? And there's nothing absolute. Even when it comes to expression of interest or freedom of, I think even the media industry themselves, they have self-regulation, right? To avoid abuse and all that. So whatever the final mechanism the government comes up with, they would need somehow to also incorporate some checks and balances to prevent abuse, you know. It's fine to talk about theories, principles, you know. At the end of the day, when it comes to implementation, we have to be very careful about abuses, right? Nobody would like their privacy right to be abused, that's for sure, right? Privacy rights talk about individuals' rights, but collectively we have to defend that, right? It's not something that concerns only individuals when it comes to that individual's rights being infringed. We should at all times, as a community, collectively defend individuals' privacy rights, although that infringement may not be imminent to ourselves at a particular point in time.
I'm afraid we only have time for one more question. Neil?
Hi, sorry, Neil Weston from Bloomberg. My ID number is P423804, brackets 8. I'm surprised you say that that this is done in the interests of enhancing the law, considering that the people who will be protected by less transparency are those with something to hide. You mentioned only 79 cases of identity theft. When I spoke with the Financial Services Bureau, they actually said that none of those cases were able to cite information from the company's registry was used. The former registrar says there was never any complaint made about privacy from 1993 to 2007. So why is this change necessary to protect a problem, to deal with a problem that isn't even there?
Because the complaints come to us and not to the key, to the company's registry, I guess, right? Because the company registry is the data user. When it comes to infringement, you know, normally people would come to the regulator. Data user would be the company's registry, would be the party against which the complaint was lodged, right? So I would expect that normally they won't have accurate figures about how much complaints they have received. You know? And some of them may not even involve, you know, well, how should I put it this way? The Hong Kong system is such that even if you have a problem about privacy in relation to personal data, you really do not know how it originated. That's a problem. If you receive a direct marketing call, for example, over the phone, there is no legal right on your part to ask for where do you get this data. If you have this legal right, things will be more tidy. Now then we can, as a regulator, ask for the problems to be dealt with at the root of the problem. That is very important, but unfortunately, despite all our appeal and all that, even the recent amendment to the ordinance has not incorporated this particular element. Sometimes when we compare ourselves with other jurisdictions, we have to bear in mind, you know, different jurisdictions are very different. In Australia, they got this through. If you got a telemarketing call, you have the legal right to say where do you get this from. And then the regulator can solve the problem at its root. But in Hong Kong, we cannot. So even if your personal data privacy is being infringed, whether the problem lies with is improper disclosure in the company's registries, personal data, or somewhere else, nobody knows. Not even perhaps not even the caller themselves know where the data comes from. It's very chaotic. So we are trying our very best in fighting an uphill battle. Disregard this imperfect system. Where possible, we should always say, again, following the principles laid down in the law, use data or collect data only when necessary. We're talking about various interests, but at the end of the day, how much weight you should put into this interest. We only know that, you know, every day on an everyday basis, the privacy to our personal data right is being infringed. It is something which we try to redress, but it is an uphill battle, because at the end of the day, we are not empowered to do it properly, to tackle the problem at its root. So we try every means, you know. When it comes to reform the company ordinance, we try to limit the data that is being shared and disclosed. Whether more should be disclosed or less, various people, various stakeholders will have to raise their voices, and the government, who is in the best position to collect the facts or possess the facts or figures themselves, or collect views and opinions from stakeholders, will come up with a full picture, accurate, reliable picture, and then convince the public that this is the best balancing arrangement.
Okay, just because Francis has promised to keep his question really short, go ahead.
Could you tell us, please, who is TransUnion? Who runs this? Who are the directors? And secondly, how many times has the chief executive's office ever asked the commissioner for privacy for a certificate not to investigate?
No, never in the history. Second question and answer to that. No. I've been in my term for 2.5 years. I've never come across that certificate, and my colleagues have not said that there's been one. So I assume there's never been any. Right? That's answer the question one. And the first question is about TransUnion. TransUnion is a international trademark. You know, TransUnion has operations in major developed economies, but TransUnion Hong Kong is a company, of course, Hong Kong-based company with interest from TransUnion International as well as shareholdings by the major banks in Hong Kong.
Great. Thank you very much again, Commissioner Cheung, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.